want me to make my contribution now or later? He asked me whether I wanted to stand up here so you could see me, but in all humility, you know, I'll let you know where I am. Yeah. I spent a good day. I am Frank, and I am an alcoholic. And I qualify very well to be identified as such. I went through the mill, and I'm not going to bore you with a 45-minute discussion about all my drinking career, but it was to the point where if I bought a newspaper, I went directly to the financial page and wanted to see how Schilling's stock was going that day. I wanted to make sure that the distillers and the food manufacturers were making it all right. And after I put the plug in the jug, I noticed that it had dropped a little bit, a few points on the market, you see. But I've had my share of it. Now, I know one thing I might explain. I kind of like to study the audience a little bit, you see. That's what you folks are, the audience, the crowd. They shouldn't have advertised who was going to talk tonight. We did probably have twice as many people here. Okay. But anyway, I've paid a lot of attention to speakers and to how they go about their business. And one thing that I have noticed is they first try to tell something funny to make you relax a little bit, you know. And they'll come off with a joke. This chap here and I identify a little bit because we have a hearing problem. And usually it's not that I don't hear you, but I can't separate the words. And I discovered that that's common with him too, that if you talk too fast, I lose you entirely. And I go to meetings, and the usual way, as I've observed even from speakers, somebody will be telling a story, and everybody will start laughing. Well, they drop the volume of their voice when they come to the punchline. So everybody's laughing, now what the hell they're laughing about? Oh, Jesus, what a great meeting, you know, everybody, you know, what the hell did he say? You know? So I have to be alert to that. So, but anyway, naturally I've got a story for you. First off, this middle-aged lady went to her doctor for her problem, and the doctor says, "Oh, Matilda, glad to see you. It's been 6 months. What's been going on? Come on into the office, sit down for a while. We'll chat before I make an examination." And so they did, and they chatted, you know, for a while, how are the kids, and all this and that and the other thing. And finally the doctor says, "Well, Matilda, what seems to be your problem that brings you to see me?" And she says, "Well, I seem to be quite gaseous lately. Develop a lot of gas. And, you know, you have to pass it." And he says, "Yeah." But she says, "When I do, it doesn't make any noise. And there's no odor." And doctor says, "Yeah. Matilda, I think I know what the problem is, but I'd kind of like a second opinion of it, so I'm referring you to a nose and ear specialist." If you didn't get it, I'll tell you tonight. Wow. Right. Anyway, that's one. You want two? You want another one before I really get into the... Yeah. Well, this lady, you know, again, she goes to the doctor, and after the appointment, she comes home, and she's standing in her bedroom, naked in front of her full-length mirror, admiring her body, you know. And her husband walks in, and he says, Louise, what in the hell are you doing? And she says, I'm just admiring myself. The doctor said that I have breasts like a 16-year-old. And he says, well, did he now? What did he say about that 51-year-old ass of yours? He says, oh, your name never came up. All right. Now we got you in the right position. The stages of alcoholism. I like to think about that because I know from my own personal experience and that of my family.
Those people in the back said they can't hear you.
Is that right?
Yeah. Is this good?
There's chairs in the front.
Yeah. Is that right? We got lots of empty chairs up here, or you can come sit on my lap. I'm going to try moving down here. Maybe that'll work. Now I screwed up your mind. Better get better. Put this on, and I have to pull my pants up. Too heavy. What's a guy that hadn't had a drink for 43 years? What's he do about it? I'm not an ordinary speaker for AA at all. I go to meetings for me and to pass on some of my experience so that it may help you, okay? But I'm not on the what they call the speaker circuit, okay? Can you hear me in the back now better than up there? Okay, you poor guy. I started talking about the stages of alcoholism. You know. There was a very, quite famous doctor by the name of Jelinek that studied alcoholism extensively in his medical career for nearly 40 years. And he came up finally with a graph. It goes like that. I had a blackboard I could draw it for you. But it's where we start, what our feelings and thinking are. Then there's stage two comes along, and some other things begin to happen. And then stage three comes along, and our ability to control, that is, when to start drinking, when to stop, how many to have at a given time, that begins to go by the wayside. And we come down to stage four, and you've got an extreme event that has to take place at stage four. You either find some way without cutting your throat to stop drinking, or you die from the consumption of alcohol. Now, I have a big argument with some of the drug people, they insist upon saying that a drug is a drug is a drug. Don't make any difference what it is, alcohol or coke or whatever, you know. But I'll guarantee you that there is some huge differences in the effects and where in the body they attack. And I want to go into that tonight. I'm kind of hung up a little bit right now on what Dr. Bob said to Bill Wilson one time. They weren't having too much success in the beginning, as you study the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Bill was hell-bent for election on the spiritual angle, okay? Well, I use that word angle kind of loosely, but that's what a lot of people say about it. There isn't any such thing as spiritual angle. It's all totally spiritual, okay? We're going to live in an entirely different world, so to speak. But anyway, Dr. Bob said to Bill, maybe we should concentrate a little more on the physical aspect of alcoholism and kind of tone down a little bit on the spirituality stuff, and maybe this would pick up a little bit. So they begin to do that. So that's what I'm going to get into just a little bit tonight, you know. In total, I don't know how many millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars have been spent on the research of alcohol and the problems developing from it and from its use and so forth. But mainly what it has all been about was to try to find a way to make, quote, a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. How can we take this ism out of the alcoholic so that he can drink and buy our stuff, you see? Because most of the people contributing to the research were the big manufacturers of booze. Okay? All right. I said a while ago that all drugs are not the same. Okay? Let's just take for an example. Alcohol goes into the mouth, down the esophagus, into the stomach, without any other thing happening to it. It goes through that barrier, right directly into the bloodstream. If you're a pregnant lady, you drink a martini. What's in that martini glass goes into your bloodstream and goes to your baby. That's why they talk about so much about the importance of, if you're pregnant or thinking you might get that way, you better lay off the drinking. Because if you can imagine a baby the size of that having a martini the same size as you just consumed, there's going to be hell break loose. Okay? So that's one thing that we got to look at. Other chemicals that we take in go through a digestive process where there's some alteration that takes place before they hit the bloodstream. Okay? Now, the important factor here that within a split second that drink bloodstream goes directly to the brain. First place it goes. And it goes to the fore part of the brain, in which is the, what I choose to call the care center, where we make decisions. We make judgment on it. We pass judgment on occurrences and so we can make a decision on it. the highway patrol, for example, or the cops, they call this what they call driving with impaired judgment, under the influence of alcohol. Okay? So, here's another thing I get hung up on. We make a lot of bad choices during our drinking careers. We screw a lot of things up. Businesses, families, communities, everything, you know, by the wrong choices we make. But if you're making a choice with an impaired information base up here, you're bound to make some bad choices. Am I not correct? Right? Because I didn't get ever stopped for drunk driving until I begin hitting other automobiles, but it's just normal driving, I probably drove 300,000 miles and never scratched a fender. And I was convinced that I could drive better with both eyes closed and you drunk than you could with both open sober, because my car was not scratched. Okay? I was a traveling salesman, for example, at one point, and my territory was in Indiana. My home base was Marion, which is about the center of the state. The Illinois line was the other end of it. I made that journey at least 300 times. I couldn't tell you what exists between Illinois and Marion, Indiana, if it would cost my life, because I was drove in a blackout all that time. I've got another interesting thing on, since I mentioned blackouts. Any of you remember the year 1962? Would you mind telling me what took place? I had a blackout that lasted exactly 1 year. And when I went back to work for this individual for whom I was working in 1962, and I had sobered up, I was sober 2 years, and he wanted me to come back to work for him, which I did, and after I figured that I'd made my amends to him, which he didn't know I owed him any, but I did. I stole time from him, right and left. But anyway, I told him that I had to go down to San Diego. This was in Gardena. And I had to go down to San Diego to another dealer to make amends to him. And he says, "For what?" And I said, "Well, for example," I said, "I don't know what happened in 1962. And he says, "What do you mean, you know?" I said, "You thought my only drinking was the one I'd have with you once in a while. We'd stop and have a martini, and then you'd go on home, and I'd leave, and you'd think I'd go on home, which I did, but I'd stop and buy my fifth or so, which I would consume before passing out for the night." So I said I was in a blackout for a total year. He went over backwards out of his executive chair, hit his head on the floor, and he picked himself up and dusted off, and he says, "For God's sakes," he says, "that's the year I gave you power of attorney of the company. And you're telling me you don't remember 1962, for God's sakes?" I said, "No." I said, "I wouldn't even question it if the IRS hadn't called me a couple of months ago and wanted to know what I was going to do about the $30,000 that I owed him in back taxes for 1962. And I said, I told the agent, I said, I know that you think you're looking at an idiot here or somebody that's pulling your leg. But I said, I don't have the slightest idea what the hell you're talking about. I owe you. And my boss packed up and he said, yeah. He said, that was the best year this company ever had. You and I both made more money that year. You see, blackout. Alcohol does a strange thing in the brain, again, what it does. Different from a lot of other drugs. You know, we're in a new age of technology now, and we've got DVDs, these things, you know. We used to have them crazy things that had a tape run on it, you know. It was shiny on one side and dull on the other, shiny side. Well, in the brain there are cells, memory cells, and it's just like that coating that goes on that tape. That's what picks up the and makes the memory. Well, alcohol shuts down the production of that chemical that puts that coating on that cell. So that's why we have blackouts, you see. Now, they may last for 5 minutes, 5 hours, 5 days, 1 year. You know what you're doing at the time, but there's nothing recorded in the memory, huh? So that's what your blackout is, you know. That's how come you can get on an airplane like I used to, with a blood alcohol of over 3. And nobody questioned you shouldn't be boarding this vehicle drunk. I wasn't drunk. But I don't remember going from Los Angeles to Tampa, Florida, and coming back 6 months later, you know, because I went for a loaf of bread down at the grocery store. There's a difference, you see. So anyway, well, that's another thing that's odd about this alcohol debt. Now, the big thing. Why, I wonder what the research industry would do if we didn't have to make ordinary controlled drinkers out of alcoholics. See? If there would be some way to do that. But to date, there isn't. What takes place is it is not the alcohol that produces this drive for more. In the body, in the brain, manufactured in the brain, is a substance that our brain makes out of alcohol. It's not alcohol per se. Alcohol is the foundation of it. And it takes this stuff and it makes something else out of it. I'm going to say this word once, and then I'm going to break it down into just letters. Tetrahydroisoquinoline. You got that? Or you remember all that? You know, repeat that after me, yeah. THIQ. The most addictive substance known to man. For example, we can take rats that are specifically bred to abhor alcohol. They won't touch anything that's around alcohol. You can put, you can get them thirsty, put a bowl of water in it, in their pen with 1% alcohol in it. They will sit there and die of thirst rather than touch that with 1% in them. Now, you can take, now the only way they can get this, they can make THIQ in the laboratory, but they can't, there's no blood test for it, because the only way you can identify it is in an autopsy after you're dead, and they check the brain and they'll find deposits of THIQ, okay, which the brain has made itself, but it's not circulating, okay? So they'll take this mouse that's about ready to die from not having a drink of water and drill a little teeny hole in its skull and put one drop of THIQ into that hole. Put the rat back into the cage, put a bowl with 50% alcohol and water in there. The little sucker will sit there and lap it up till he falls and passes out. It's that powerful. Okay? So, science can't find the answer to it. Alcoholics Anonymous can. All it says is don't take that first drink. That's what it's all about, kids. The only way to stop the manufacture of this crap up here, THIQ, is to don't put any alcohol in there for it to make it out of. Okay? So we're on a physical standpoint now. I'm talking. That's why the first drink is so damn important. Because once it does, then you have to have the next drink. That goes to the brain. That works on this impaired information center here, and you start making bad decisions. And it starts making THIQ again, which demands some more of it so it can make some more THIQ. There's no satisfying it. Okay? Now, what's cocaine do? Does cocaine do that? She's not happy here.
No, he said it had rat poisoning in it.
Oh, well, never mind. You don't have to put any rat poisoning in it. No, we're talking about the good stuff, you know, the real stuff. Where does cocaine go? It goes into the bloodstream. It's been through the stomach, right? Even though it goes into the nose, gets picked up a little bit with some capillaries and so forth into the bloodstream. It does not go here to this care center first. It bypasses that and two other sections of the brain that control the involuntary and voluntary actions of our body. Okay? Now you're all sitting here, and obviously there's a bunch of hearts beating. Have you told your heart to beat lately? And I expect, since there's nobody coughing for air, that you're breathing. I haven't noticed anybody saying, hey, why don't you breathe a little bit here, you know? The involuntary procedure going on in the brain. Cocaine goes directly to that. Okay? Bypasses this. That's why coconuts, we call them. People hooked on cocaine. Coconut's a good name for them, you know? They think they're so smart and so swift because it hasn't attacked this care center here. And, gosh, they can add and subtract quick and everything else, you know. But it's gone right to this involuntary part of the brain here. So and I have to get into something else about a drug is a drug is a drug is bullshit, you know. There's too much difference in them. Okay? That's one big difference with cocaine and alcohol. It attacks a different part of the brain right off the bat, okay? Alright. Now, can you overdose and kill yourself by drinking alcohol? Yeah, but it's got to be like the college students run into every now and then, and they have a razzing or whatever the hell they call it, and they bet some guy that he can't drink a pint of this without stopping, and he does, and he falls over dead. That's how you can kill yourself, drinking alcohol quick. The average male, 150 pounds weight, if he drinks without stopping, one pint, 90 proof whiskey, will within 5 seconds drop dead. But alcohol is kind of nice to us in one way. We go night-night before we get to that point. Okay? We're sitting at the bar and, you know, we're tossing them down and so forth. Pretty soon the bartender says, well, he's finally gone to sleep now, so we can cut him off. Okay? Probably cut me off about 2 drinks before I took the fatal dose. Okay? Which I used to do. Anyhow, are all other drugs like that? Ooh, no. You can overdose. Let's take what happens. Say heroin. You take the iron cure, in other words, the pick you up for something else and throw you in the slammer and put you behind the iron bars, okay? And you come off of it. You've been up to $500 a day and it's getting a little bit too expensive. Started with $5 a day and it went to $500, right? There ought to be some identification with that. Anyway, but anyway, you detoxify from the heroin, and you go back out, and well, maybe that day, or maybe you've been in the slammer for 60 days, right? So you ought to be pretty well cleaned up. Where do you start? Up at the 500? Uh-huh. You start back at the 5. That's where you get the same bang. At the $5 that you got, it took $500 to get. Yeah. And this just keeps going up with this, with the narcotics, until you reach a lethal point. There's no coming down. Alcohol has a critical point, which I finally reached, and most will. You know, when most people think of alcoholics, they're thinking about them bums down on 4th Avenue in L.A. or something, you know, and army overcoats and so forth from World War One, and a half-empty jug of wine. Alcohol, you build up your tolerance, like you did with heroin or coke or whatever. It takes more to get the same effect each time. A little bit more, a little bit more. So, well, and don't take this as braggadocio, because it all depends on for how much behavior control you have, not control over how much consumption you have, behavior control. I call it compensation for being too drunk to walk. Okay? I was farming back in the state of Michigan. We fed hogs, slaughter, we fed beef cattle for slaughter, we had a dairy, we sold milk, we had strawberries, cherries, you name it, you know. It was quite an operation. It went on all year long. Alcohol's got a lot of calories in it, it ain't got any vitamins. So I was working 18 hours a day on a steady basis and on a farm, and usually work 7 days a week, you know, and putting away two-fifths of Jack Daniels a day. And I switched just because I thought maybe somebody could smell Jack Daniels, so I switched to gin. And but I was putting away two-fifths a day, working 18 hours a day, doing what I said to do, taking care of all this stuff, you know. And you can get hurt around cattle and hogs and everything else if you're drunk, but I could compensate for my behavior, and my tolerance to alcohol kept building and building and building. But I reached a critical point, which we all will do before we hit the terminal death stage. One drink, and I'd fall off the bar stool. Just ask the old bartenders at Sweeney's Bar. You don't know, you guys are too young to know Sweeney's Bar, but there used to be a hotel, the Harvey Hotel, Skid Row Hotel. I had the presidential suite in the Harvey Hotel. It had the bathtub in it. That's why it was the presidential suite. I've been here for a while. You go to the grocery store, you ever see these Sam Cooksey eggs? Any of you buy Sam Cooksey's eggs? You know what I'm talking about? Yeah, there's a few nodding. Okay? I moved into the room that Sam Cooksey moved out of. Sam Cooksey went down to Alcoholics Anonymous meeting down there by the olive plant, and he moved out. You know the olive plant I talk about? Somebody just bought it, and now it's a kind of a depot, and they rebuild it, fancies of it, and so forth. Johnny George bought that. When I moved out of the Harvey Hotel, Johnny George's father, Frank George, moved in. And his son Johnny has taken care of the roofing business ever since. But his father finally went where Sam went, down to Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. I know I got to wrap something up here. I got to tell you about the night I arrived at Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been drinking as usual. I couldn't go to work. I had a new job. Nobody else in the United States would hire me. I had been the number three tractor salesman in the United States in that year, 1962. And I went from being number three in the United States down to being blackballed by every tractor dealer in the United States. Nobody touched me with a 10-foot pole. is the best salesman you'll ever find, but you'll never know where in the hell he is or whether he's going to show up or not. So forget it. Well, I got a job up here anyway. Determined not to drink. Bought me a pint on the Greyhound bus on the way up from Los Angeles to Visalia. I didn't know where Visalia was, but I wasn't going to drink anymore. I wonder why I stopped and bought a pint, which I consumed. Oh, anyway, this went on. I would open Sweeney's bar when the bartender opened it up at 6 o'clock in the morning. And believe you me, I wasn't the only businessman in town that was there. A lot of them. Okay? And if at all possible, I would remain there until 2 a.m. when they had to close down. I'm alive today for a variety of reasons. Number one, there was a cop that walked the beat at night. And I think Jerry has got about 15 years on the program now. But when they closed down Sweeney's at night, I couldn't walk. I was too drunk. I would crawl. So thank goodness Jerry would be there, and he would stop traffic so they didn't run over poor Frank while he was getting across the street to the Harvey Hotel to go to bed. Okay. Well, it took a few years, but Jerry followed me. Anyway, he's still alive, by the way. Give him a lot of credit. But anyway, what else happened? This particular night, March 16th, 1966, I'd been drinking all day. I went into Sweeney's bar about 5 minutes to eight. The bartender, Red, I can say his name because his full name because he's in the cemetery, Red Logan. Red Logan was a bartender. And Red says to me, as he said, the double early times with a dash of water in it in front of me. He said, Frank, you have to stop drinking. And I said, what the hell are you talking about? Aren't you the bartender to sell booze? Yes, but he says, I'd say that in about 2 weeks you're going to be dead. And I said, oh yeah? Well, what do you suggest on stopping? Well, he said, try Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, oh? Well, I did, 6 years ago. And that didn't work. Well, 6 years before that, I was driving a company car, had a radio telephone in it, and I was a high-powered salesman, and I went to an AA meeting, and these guys had short pants on, and T-shirts, and I got my three-piece suit and tie on, you know. Who's going to pay any attention to them? I'd drink, too, if I was like them. And another guy on crutches, you know, both legs off to here, giving a pitch, and he's talking about how much in love he is with his wife, and she weighed 475 pounds at least. And I said, Jesus Christ, I'd drink too if I was married to her, you know. And, so I went to 30 meetings in 30 days, and I didn't hear anything. I particularly didn't hear that this program will work providing you don't put alcohol in. Well, I didn't hear that. So I'd drink before the meeting and I'd go put cotton in my ear so I wouldn't get all interrupted and upset and go home and finish my bottle. And so that didn't work, right? Well, he says, you see me take a drink? And I said, no, Red. Hammer. He says, you've been coming in here for 2 months, Frank. He says, you never see me take a drink, do you? I said, no. He said, I go. I said, is that right? He said, yeah. He said, by the way, he said, there's a meeting on tonight. It happened to be Wednesday night. Look at what I'm doing on a Wednesday night, for Christ's sake. Here we are, okay? So I tossed down my double. I'm already smashed, and I start down to walk. It's foggy. I made it to the Bridge Street overpass. My courage left me. My determination left me. I had lost everything. Family, kids, work, everything was gone. I decided I would kill myself. I would take a nosedive off of the Bridge Street onto the freeway. So I'm up there and I got one leg over the rail. Small rails, you know. And I'm about ready to get the other one over and go. And a hand reached out and grabbed my shoulder and pulled me back. And the voice says, hey, hold it there, buddy. Take a walk with me. We'll be gone about an hour. And if you still want to do this, I'll walk you back. And I'll put the other leg over and I'll give you a shove. Have we got a deal? I said, I guess I can give you an hour of my precious time. So I hung on to him and he propped me up against the door, opened the door, I fell in flat on my face. Couldn't get up by myself. They come, six guys come pick me up, planted my butt in a chair. They were very nice and cordial. They said, we're certainly glad to see you. Sit down, shut up, and we'll hear from you next year. My goodness. I hadn't gone one day without alcohol for 26 years. And from that day to this day, alcohol has never crossed my lips in 43 years. What in the hell happened? AA happened to me. Okay. I know I got to shut up because we're out of time. But see, I could go on. I'm just really getting rolling here, you know. I took some advice from the last guy that asked me to speak. You remember I had my oxygen tank with me, and I haven't got a hold of me afterwards, and he said, I should have taken that tank away from you, Frank. He said, you talked for an hour and a half. So I didn't even bring it tonight, so I can obey the rules. But anyway, we got to shut up. I hope I haven't insulted anybody tonight. I wish I had one more joke for you. I really do, but it's too dirty. I haven't told you. Anyway.